You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. On tonight's program, Liz Olds talks with Michael Oren about his work, Swan's War. With World War II raging overseas and most able-bodied male men away in the service, Mary Beth Swan is left in charge as police captain of the rugged New England fishing island Fourth Cliff. When a murdered POW surfaces in a fisherman's net, followed by more bodies, Swan is determined to find the killer.
Then, in the last part of the hour, Josh talks with Alan Miller about his political thriller, Holding Court. When a Supreme Court justice is kidnapped at term's end to keep him from being the critical deciding vote in a monumental environmental issue, a young reporter and his professor/fiancé lead readers through a dizzying series of events with suspects everywhere. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Hello, Liz, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, how you doing?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
Oh, great. I'm doing great.
And Michael, can you hear us?
I'm here.
All right, great. You're on Right on Radio.
Okay.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, everybody.
Welcome to Right on Radio.
Right on Radio.
Thanks for joining us this evening.
I'm delighted. Thank you for having me.
Why don't you start with a brief description of the book and dive right into your reading?
Okay, we're ready to go.
Yep, we're ready to go. So you can dive right into your reading if you'd like.
Right now? Okay.
Yep.
In the otherwise flat stretch of island between the town and the northern tip was a slightly depressed, somewhat moister swath known as the Moors. Nondescript, scrubby, the area was best known for its saline soil, inhospitable to all but the most tenacious plants. Among them, though, was the broom crowberry, a thorny shrub with little to commend it most of the year. Only in late March did it make its presence known, if not celebrated. With reddish-orange petals, many too tiny for a distant eye to see, the crowberry heralded the spring. Stopping the coupe on the roadside, Mary Beth got out and admired them. Though scarcely flamboyant, these first flowers made her feel wistful. It brought her back to the early springs of her childhood, with black snow still clogging the gutters and the branches bare, but the icicles dripping silver and the colors of old hopscotch courts resurrecting on the street. Such memories reminded her of her mother, urging her to go out and play. Winter's over, she announced with the fullness of her strength, live. But life for her was ebbing. Already feverish, with a swollen neck and a bark-like cough, Colleen Boyle was exhibiting the disease that would swiftly kill her. Until her last breath, though, she remained indomitable, and in Mary Beth's mind, a saint. While often strict with her 8-year-old daughter, she also adored her, sewed and baked gingerbread for her, pampered her whenever her husband wasn't looking. Her mother smelled of cinnamon, applesauce, and bleach. Her hands were soft and unyielding. They had a lot in common, the Boyle girls, severe beauty, hardy hips and shoulders, the same stubborn streak, and a refusal to complain even in the face of anguish. Her eyes, like her daughter's, were emerald. And while her father scoffed at her desire to become a policewoman, her mother encouraged it. I can see you now, my little darling, with your badge and your cap. The bad guys will pick up and run. Mary Beth loved her mother, but for a long time, hated her, resented her for dying so young and leaving her to be raised by an intolerant man, embittered and cold, angry that she made her go out and play when the temperature was still freezing and snow clung to the gutters, for wrapping her up in her coat, hat, and mittens instead of embracing her and promising her that she'd always be there when she returned. Bluebells, cockleshells, Mary Beth recited out loud, Evie, Ivy, over. Her shoes lifted up and down on the pavement. Mother went to market to buy some meat. Babies in the cradle, fast asleep. Yes, it would be warmer soon, and all the flowers would blossom, but her world would remain wintry. By the windlash moors, Mary Beth zipped up her jacket and clutched its lapels to her throat. The crowberry could bloom and spring might come, but Archie had abandoned her, just like her mother. She was alone again, this time with a murderer on the loose and an island that wanted her gone. Through icy squares, it felt, she was once again hopping and trying her best not to slip.
That was Michael Oren reading an excerpt from his book, Swan's War. Mary Beth becomes an adult. And during World War II, of course, we know many women took over traditionally male jobs and responsibilities. We know Rosie the Riveter, for example. Mary Beth decides to take up her husband's police captain bars. And I'm wondering if you could explain why she does that and how she felt about it.
Well, going back to the 1940s, there really weren't any police women. They were called women policemen, and they didn't carry guns and they didn't walk beats. They were used mostly for getting prostitutes and urchins off the streets. But Mary Beth wanted to be a real policewoman. Her father was a policeman, her grandfather was a policeman. They scoffed to her too. She meets Archibald Swan, who's the captain of police of Fourth Cliff Island, 20 miles off the coast of Massachusetts. You won't find it on a map because I made up the island. It's an imaginary island, but it's great detail. And she moves to this island with her, with Archie. And there she's really an outsider. She's an Irish woman from South Boston. And here she is with these rather crusty mariners who don't take very well to her, not very inviting. But then World War II breaks out and Archie is a Marine Reserve officer. And he gets called into the South Pacific and leaves her in charge of the island. And there's no law other than Mary Beth Swan, and which would be okay. But on the island, the U.S. military has imprisoned 90 Italian prisoners of war. And this is actually true in World War II. Some 51,000 Italian prisoners of war were kept in the United States, kept separate from the Germans, by the way. And they're put to work because of the same labor shortage. They worked in farming, they worked in fishing. And Mary Beth maintains the peace as best she can, but then one after another, these Italian prisoners of war show up dead. And so in addition to being alone, in addition to being in that hostile environment, Mary Beth has to find a serial killer.
And the reaction to Mary Beth being the captain and taking up the captain's bars on the island ranges. She has one friend, but it ranges from ambivalence to downright hostile.
Yes.
And I'm wondering how she copes with that, including in the situation where she's searching for a serial killer.
Well, she's a human being, and she has her flaws, she has her insecurities. She loves her husband very much, but she's also angry at him. As a police officer, he didn't have to answer the call to fight in the war. He could have stayed at home. He doesn't. He felt duty bound to go off and be with his men in the Marines. There are times of great self-doubt for Mary Beth Swan, where she doesn't think she could rise to the occasion. She asks herself all the time, what would Archie do? And she does have one friend, the owner of a local bar, a woman who also has an interesting life story and has to deal with constant opposition to her personality or her orientation. Mary Beth comes to rely on Minnie, the owner of the bar. It is not easy. That's why it's called Swan's War, and because it's not only World War II, but it's Mary Beth's personal war to succeed in this job as police captain of Fourth Cliff Island.
Why did you decide to set it in an island in Massachusetts?
I have no idea. It just occurred to me that way. I made up the island. It's not a real island.
Right.
And the book opens with a map of the island. So it's pretty detailed imagination. I enjoyed it. I had spent some time in Nantucket, and Fourth Cliff is referred to as a poor man's Nantucket. And I had a sense of the geography. I had a sense of the industry. One of the big industries on the island is cranberry farming. So I had to learn about cranberry farming. I had to learn about lobster fishing. I think that it's a dramatic setting. going back in a deep American tradition, you know, going back to Moby Dick. It's a dramatic setting, that maritime coast. Very rugged, very cold, and it can be very lonely.
What is it about World War II that that caused you to want to write about it?
Well, it's not the first time I've written about World War II. It's my second novel that's set in World War II or about World War II. My father was a decorated veteran, fought from Normandy all the way through the war. He passed away last year, and he certainly left me with that legacy. I think World War II for Americans harkens back to a simpler time where good was good and evil was evil. The lines were clearly drawn, but also a time of hardship where people who were raised in the Depression, who were themselves rather tough, had to deal with very difficult circumstances. So Mary Beth, in addition to being alone, has to deal with rationing. There's no coffee. There's very little sugar.
Oh, dear.
There are people on the island whose sons have been wounded or even killed in the war. He has to deal with bereavement and the constant tension of not knowing what's happening. There's a correspondence between Mary Beth and her husband, Archie, who's fighting in the Pacific, and he's fighting in these terrible jungles. And he writes to her about what his life is like there. And she writes to him back. So the war is very much a presence in this book. It's on the radio all the time. There's news and people are either celebrating or mourning, depending on what's happening on the battlefields overseas.
It's like a character in the book, the war is.
Very much so, very much so.
Are there any people in the book that are based on real people that you knew or know?
No, apart from President Roosevelt and J. Edgar Hoover, who don't appear in the book, but there's lots of references to them, to Mussolini, certainly, because some of the Italian prisoners of war are still loyal to the fascists, and there's conflict within the prisoner of war camp. But no, all the characters are completely fictitious, and I'm not even quite sure where this novel came from. Just one day I looked up, and there was Mary Beth Swan saying, you know, good to meet you, I'm your character.
We're speaking with Michael Oren, author of Swan's War, a book about a woman who becomes a police captain on an island. How much research did you do? What kind of research did you do for the book?
Well, I'm a history professor by training, and I've written a history book, so I was able to draw on my historical research skills. So, for example, I had to know what people wore in the 1940s. I had to know how they spoke, and language was pretty different. And I would check every line. I gotta tell you, honestly, I had one line where someone said game over, and I went and checked it in the dictionary, and it turned out game over the first time was used in 1970. So that had to go. I had to, what people ate, what they didn't eat, what they drove. I had to find about the intricate and inner workings of a 1941 Harley Davidson motorcycle. Serious research. And I learned a lot. I really learned a lot. One of the things I learned was, you know, it's well known that the United States government quite atrociously rounded up Japanese Americans and put them in basically kind of concentration camps during World War II. But it was not known to me that the government did the same thing to thousands and thousands of Italian Americans, using the same presidential decree, that's an order. And it was kept secret for decades. It wasn't even until 2001 that this was made public. And many thousands of Italian Americans suffered under this order, including Joe DiMaggio's parents. And this is at a time when one out of every 10 American GIs was an Italian American. That oppression of Italian Americans during the war becomes an important part in the book.
Just curious, what is your history specialty? What is your main love?
I do modern Middle Eastern history. I have a PhD in Middle Eastern history, and I taught Middle history. I've written about the 1967 Middle Eastern War. I have a comprehensive history of America in the Middle East called Power, Faith, and Fantasy, and for almost 5 years, starting in 2009, I served as Israel's ambassador to the United States of America, and I wrote about that as well.
What does an ambassador do, for those of us who are ignorant about that?
An ambassador represents his government, or her government, to another government, a foreign government. In the case of the United States, is representing the counterparts to Congress. It's 530 members of Congress, the entire administration, the Pentagon, the CIA, but it's also far beyond government. It's representing peoples. And to various, there was never a weekend where I wouldn't be in some church or synagogue and being on the media. I've done all the major media shows that you know and love in the United States, everything from Colbert to The View several times, and always out there representing and explaining and reaching out and making connections. It's a very human position.
Fiction and nonfiction, you've written both. Is there one you prefer, or is there a difference in your process, or how does that work?
Well, certainly there's a difference in the process. I think they come from different parts of my brain and or different parts of my soul, if you will. I started out as a poet at 12 years old, and I proudly published my first poem at 14 in 17 magazine, and went on to write plays and short stories. This is my fifth work of fiction. And I've written two collections of short stories and three novels. And so fiction, I adore it. It's much less labor intensive, certainly, in history. And a history book will take about 4 or 5 years, and a novel will take a year. But in both cases, it's very deeply felt, and it's a very spiritual experience, I must tell you. I scarcely remember writing these books when I'm finished, because it's almost like a trance.
Mm-hmm. And are all your books fiction books mystery besides the short stories? Are they all mysteries, or?
But this was my first whodunit, true whodunit. And I must tell you, whodunit is one of the most difficult things I've ever had to write. You got to read your reader down all these different, you know, blind alleys and dead ends. And at the end of the book, when the mystery is resolved, the reader can't say, oh, that's, you know, malarkey. The reader has to say, ah, how come I didn't see that coming? And be a surprise at the same time. So it, in terms of just calibrating it and orchestrating, it's very difficult. I often have written about crime, though. It has been pointed out to me. I didn't even notice this. People say, hey, why are you always writing about crimes? My previous novel was centered around a murder. It wasn't much of a mystery, but it was a murder. Many of my short fiction deals with various crimes. So there's something there that attracts me. I don't know what it is. I'm not sure I want to know.
Do you like reading mysteries and crime books, or did it just appear from whole cloth?
I love reading, and I'm reading at any given time. I'm reading at least two books, and sometimes they're mysteries, sometimes they're not. And I think that writing this book has given me a very deep appreciation for the masters of whodunits and mystery writers, because it's very challenging.
Who are some of your influences in mystery?
Well, in mystery, I just generally speaking, I love the great American writer Ambrose Bierce, who had a wonderful way of twisting endings, and a very modern writer who wrote 150 years ago. It's extraordinary to read him today. I love Elizabeth Strout. She's not a mystery writer, but she writes about Maine and she writes about love. And I read every word she puts out. I think she's a magnificent writer. So I deeply appreciate these authors, and they've had a great influence on me.
Let's talk some about your life as an ambassador. I'm first curious, as an ambassador, how you feel about the war in Ukraine. What are we doing right? What we could do better in the United States?
Well, my own government, the Israeli government, came out as neutral early in the war, and I opposed it. I'm a frequent commentator in the news. I was the Middle East analyst for CBS News and for CNN News. So I'm on TV a lot. And I didn't like our neutrality. I thought it was strategically wrong, and I thought it was morally wrong. I think there's a country that Ukraine that's fighting for its liberty, a fellow democracy. And I think that all democracy had to stand four square behind Ukraine. I think that the American policy up to date has been very sound. It has been designed to deplete the Russian army, but not quite defeat the Russian army. And the big danger now is the Russian army might be defeated. And I am concerned. I am concerned that if Mr. Putin is put into a corner, he's liable to do something rather rash. And it wouldn't be too premature to be thinking about creative diplomacy, how this entire horrible war could be diffused.
What is the most intense thing that you have dealt with as an ambassador?
Oh, I've dealt with various crises and wars. I myself have spent many years in the military and have been in war several times. So it, I know what it feels like to be on both on the receiving end and the managing end of these conflicts. And it was difficult. It was it's something very personal thing. If there's a tourist who falls off a cliff, literally, and mm-hmm. you have to break that news to a family, the ambassador has to do that too.
Mm-hmm. What about COVID? How do you feel like, again, the U.S. is doing right and wrong, Israel is doing right, could do better. What do you think about the pandemic?
I think that we have to go back and review some of the measures we had adopted. Israel was actually a world leader in lockdowns, and we were the first fully vaccinated country in the world. In retrospect, I think that we have to go back and very closely examine whether those policies were warranted.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that I'm wondering about, we in the United States, we suffer from a lot of, unfortunately, mass shootings. And I'm wondering if you have ideas of you're familiar with other countries and how they deal with it and what you think we could do, again, better or differently or more like other countries.
You're actually touching on one of the most difficult issues I had to explain to my fellow countrymen and women. They would say to me, you know, if America has the biggest, most powerful army in the world, why do Americans need so many guns? And I'd have to explain to them that in the minds of many Americans, they need those guns to protect them from the most powerful army in the world, that guns in America are related to freedom. Under the Constitution. And Israelis don't understand this. Most people in the world don't understand this. We live in a war zone. Very, very few Israelis have guns, less than 3% of the population. I've never owned a gun.
Oh.
And so it's an alien notion for much of the world and difficult to explain. And frankly, I don't know how you change it in the United States, and how you would make it more difficult for people who are liable to open fire on a school or a shopping center to prevent them from getting those firearms.
Yes. Leaders in the world, who are some that you respect, look up to?
Well, I respect Mr. Zelensky. I think he's done an extraordinary job. A person who came out of, you know, a comedy show about presidents, and he ends up being quite an historical figure and rising to the occasion. Very, very impressive. So he is certainly a leader I impress. I've had the privilege of working with great leaders. Not all of them I agreed with, but they were certainly extraordinary individuals. Everyone from Barack Obama to Shimon Peres, Benjamin Netanyahu, who looks like he's been reelected now, the longest serving prime minister in Israel's history. European leaders, pretty much met them all in my career. And you get to appreciate what it means to be a leader, what kind of qualities you need. You have to be a great communicator. You have to be a great politician, because if you're not a great politician, you're not going to be a great leader. You won't be reelected. And you have to be a great decision maker. And in many ways, that's the hardest thing, is to make decisions. And so frequently, there's never a good decision. There's only a less bad decision. Mm-hmm. And I tell you over and over again, it's the less bad decision. And having to make that is a very lonely task.
We're coming up on our elections next week, very important midterm elections. What can you say about elections?
Well, first of all, the fact that elections are taking place, democracy is under duress throughout much of the world. And we thought, you know, with the fall of the Soviet Union, that back in 1989, that was it, that the liberal democracy had won out. And now we see a resurgence going a different way. So let's take a moment to appreciate the fact that that the elections are even taking place.
Yes.
I'm concerned, without getting involved in internal American politics, I'm concerned about the the foundations of democracy, which include, among other things, a loyal minority. When a party loses an election, it has to be able to say to the other party, okay, we lost, but you're the senator, you're the congressman, you're Mr. President, and we will be loyal to that person. If you lose that, you've really lost a very foundational element of democracy. Very difficult. The world looks to the United States, still very much looks to the United States as an example. So some of the trends in this country are for me very disconcerting. And I hope that America will discover some element of unity again, because the polarization has been very extreme.
Yes, yes, I agree. And I think, I suppose you would agree that it's very important to get out and vote, no matter what your personal beliefs are, to get out and do that.
Yeah, Israel has one of the, if not the highest, one of the highest rates of voter participation. There was an election held this morning, and it was the highest level of voter participation in over two decades.
Well, what did you like most about being an ambassador?
I love the interaction with communities. I mentioned my father had fought in World War II, and I had a strong connection with the U.S. military. I visited all the academies. I visited major bases. And I enjoyed interacting with the military. I enjoyed going to churches. I enjoyed dealing with the great kaleidoscope of American society. Many people today see it as a point of divisiveness, but what I saw it was all just richness, and it was fascinating, endlessly fascinating. As Israeli ambassador, I also had a very interesting interaction with the American Muslim community.
Hmm.
Yeah, I actually instituted, I don't know if you know what an iftar is. Iftar is the feast during the holy month of Ramadan that you break the fast. And I instituted an Israeli iftar, which is still being held. And in many ways, kind of my proudest achievement. And that involved interacting with American Muslim leaders. And these are people who don't agree with you. Okay, I understand this, but you can interact on the level of common faith, common respect, common humanity.
Kind of a decent disagreeal, or a decent knowledge of new things that are new to you.
True. I mean, I had studied Islamic history and had read the Quran. I studied Arabic for years, so I had a basis for understanding. But that doesn't mean we agreed. Politically, we didn't on many issues. On some, we did. There have been a peace accords. Made in the Middle East, the Abraham Accords, and much of those accords were animated by common threats, and particularly the threat of Iran.
We've been speaking with Michael Oren, author of Swan's War. When is this coming out, or has it already
It is out. It is out in the bookstores. The reviews have been very, very good. Can't complain about the reviews. I hope the people enjoy it. It is, honestly, as objectively as I can, it is a fun and engaging read. And I think that Mary Beth Swan is a multifaceted and very real protagonist.
Yeah, she's a great character. I really enjoyed the book. What's next for you? What are you working on now?
I'm completing my second collection of short stories. My last one was called The Night Archer, which is 51 stories, which are very, very different. I don't have a title yet for my next collection. I'm finishing up a nonfiction book, which will be coming out in next April, which deals with what Israel should look like on its 100th birthday, which will be in 2048, very policy driven. And ultimately, I have a contract with Random House to write a book about the founding of Israel in 1948.
Okay, well, that's about all we have here. I really enjoyed talking to you. Again, this has been Michael Oren, author of Swan's War, a novel about a woman who takes on the captaincy of the police on a small island. And it is very, very interesting. And so thank you very much. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Delightful talking to you as well. Thank you for hosting me.
Great, great. Thank you. I'm going to turn it back over to Josh now, if he's there.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Alan, I can hear you.
Okay.
Turn me your volume a little bit, but otherwise I'm glad to have you here.
Well, I'm here.
Okay, Alan, we're on air right now for Right on Radio. If you have your first reading, you're welcome to start anytime.
No intro, huh?
Well, I will give you your intro.
All right, I'm ready.
Okay, go ahead for your reading.
This book is about the kidnapping of a Supreme Court justice. And among the main characters, probably the leading protagonists, are a young reporter from the Washington Post named Mort Ahrens, and his fiancée, who used to be a law clerk to the justice, and her name is Dani Rose. So when the justice disappears, Mort is sitting at his desk when he gets a call. Mort was at his desk in the Washington Post newsroom when his cell phone sounded with a distinctive ringtone, the cavalry charge. His cubicle was one of many in the newspaper's bullpen. His personal cell phone, stashed in the pocket of his jacket, which was draped over the back of his chair, was strictly for calls from Dani, family members, and close friends. His work mobile sat on the desk next to an old-fashioned landline. He reached back, dug out his personal phone, and looked at the screen. Dani. Mort was not a Robert Redford lookalike, at least not the Redford from All the President's Men. He was more of a Mr. Average, 5'8" with unkempt sandy hair, large tortoiseshell glasses, a rumpled blue shirt with sleeves rolled up, and a fashionable, unintentional one-day growth beard. All around him, other Washington Post reporters were hunched over their computers, chatting on their phones, or staring off while contemplating obstacles to completing their current mission.
Very good.
We'll now talk about what she said to him. "Mort, JJ is missing," she said, her voice an octave higher than usual. "What do you mean, missing? He didn't show up in court this morning. He'd never miss a day, especially now. I just got a call from Lucille, his law clerk, who had called the house and spoken with Lupe. JJ left as usual this morning. She checked the garage. He left on the Harley, but he never got to the court. What could have happened?" Well, Mort was then very, very concerned about what could have happened, and we'll jump ahead a few pages. And we'll talk about the fact that he was a little upset because he was the fourth call that Dani had made, and he wondered just where he was on the priority list. But he decided to meet her in Gaithersburg at the Montgomery County Police Headquarters, where their friend was the chief of the Montgomery County Police. As Mort drove toward Gaithersburg to meet with Dani, with Travis, and whoever else they gathered, he felt some of his usual guilt. His agreement to JJ's plan for an engagement ring was undoubtedly the cause of JJ's disappearance. And it was happening when Travis was consumed with a triple murder case. He called Dani on his cell phone. She answered. "Doesn't Travis have enough to do with the triple killing?" Mort asked. Dani snapped back. "A Supreme Court justice disappears on his watch, practically family to boot. He's got a whole department to solve that case. JJ is special." Mort didn't mention anything about the availability of the Supreme Court police, the Capitol Police, the U.S. Marshals, the Secret Service, or the FBI. Dani and JJ had a special bond between them ever since she'd clerked for him, then moved into his home to chauffeur him to court after he had broken his ankle. That and the fact that her mother and JJ were now a couple. Mort's cell phone rang, and he saw the call coming from the Washington Post. "Ahrens," he said. "Ahrens, Ginsburg here. Where are you right now?" Mort almost crashed the car. Steven Ginsberg was the managing editor of the Washington Post. They had never actually met, except the day Ginsberg was given an introductory pep talk to the staff after he was named to his position. "Mr. Ginsberg," he stammered. "Yes, where are you? They tell me that you have some sort of special relationship with Justice Richter, correct?" "Yes, through my fiance. She used to be his law clerk. I was with him last evening, in fact." "Last evening? Well, where the hell is he today?" "We got a tip that he's missing." Mort was now in a state of panic. The word was out. Suddenly, he had to pee. He didn't say anything. "Ahrens, are you still there?" Ginsberg asked. "Yes, sir." "Well, drop whatever you're doing and find him. I want you on this story. Capiche?" "Yes, sir, I'm on it." "And it's Stephen. We're not in the goddamn army. I want you to report directly to me." "Yes, sir, Stephen, I got it. I'm on it." Mort made a U-turn and headed back toward D.C. He called Danny again, got her voicemail, and left a somewhat incoherent message. And that's a bit of a reading.
Very good. That was award-winning author and media personality Alan Miller. He has a background in law, teaching in colleges, universities, law schools, served in government, and has been published nationally and internationally. He resides in Minnesota with his wife, Sharon, and Springer Rescue, Katie. His first novel is Holding Court, a political thriller in the vein of a John Grisham novel. That's an action-packed adventure, which includes drones, illegal surveillance, eavesdropping, high-tech weaponry, spying, ransom, and a cast iron frying pan, which becomes a weapon. Alan Miller, welcome to Write on Radio.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be with you, Josh.
So, Alan, the one thing I didn't mention in your bio is that you have a background in screenwriting. I was curious about, did screenwriting prepare you for the writing process of a novel?
I don't think actually screenwriting per se did. It certainly was very helpful, but not in terms of novel writing. It's so different than writing a novel. Writing a novel is so different than anything I have done. I've written a couple of nonfiction books, but writing a novel is an exercise in and of itself.
How's it different?
Well, screenwriting, you are pretty much stuck with a formula, and you have to live within that formula. With writing a novel, you create the formula, and that's what I did in this one. And I also had help from some really good writers who looked at my earlier drafts and tore me to shreds, which helped me turn out to be what is a very well-reviewed book.
Something that I really like that you do well in this novel is you manage to balance multiple perspectives. We see the kidnappers, we see from JJ's point of view, we see from Danny and Mort's, and you do this with ease, really, throughout the novel. And was that something, that tip that the authors you worked with helped you?
Unquestionably that helped me.
Okay.
Also, it's just the way that I write. I don't like to write from one perspective. I like to put yourself in the mind of several people and see what they're going through to reach our conclusion.
I think you have a very interesting background. I do want to talk about the book, but one thing I did want you to share with our listeners is a quick story about your screenwriting past. You had a screenplay that was made into a Hollywood film, but you did not get screenwriting credit for. Could you talk about what that movie was and how you found this out?
Well, you're talking about 7 days, 6 nights.
Yeah.
And I had written it about 4 days before, 4 years before it appeared on screen. And I was actually in the theater because I was a Harrison Ford fan and I liked his movies. And all of a sudden I see this movie on screen and I turned to my wife and I said, "Damn it, that's my movie." And it was. It was my movie with a couple of changes in it, but it was almost chapter and verse what I had written. And to say that was infuriating is an understatement.
Did you sit through the whole movie then? What did you do?
Oh, absolutely. I wasn't going to.
Oh, that's crazy. Alan, I have my notes here. Correct me if I'm wrong. You're 88 years old. Is that right?
That's what it says in your notes, so it must be right.
You're above 30 is what I actually have my notes. But I was
above 30.
You're above 30. So
I am above 30 doubled, and I'm almost close to 30 tripled.
The reason I'm saying this, I mean, I hope you're not shy about your age, but I want to talk about it because you are proof that there is not a point in a person's life where you cannot start something new or interesting or write your first novel. And how long did it take you to work on this prior to its publication?
Well, actually, I had the original idea of the judge being kidnapped about a decade ago. And at that time, I was looking at fracking. I was trying to keep something topical. Well, fracking came and went, even though it's still with us. So I switched to wind and solar in terms of making the subject. In this book, of course, the question is water. And I was kind of prescient about 2-3 years ago. I said, water is going to be the next thing that the world is going to be going to war over and fighting over. So I focused the book on that. And the fight that ended up in the Supreme Court. And there we are.
What advice would you give to someone who's struggling to finish their novel?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'm working on the second volume right now. And yesterday was not a good day, but I wrote. And today, when I came back, I destroyed everything that I wrote yesterday. And what you have to do, you have to be persistent. You have to really put your mind to it. You have to, and it was very difficult for me in the beginning to destroy my own words. It's like shooting your children, you know, because when they come out of your fingertips onto the computer, you think, well, this is definitely an Academy Award. This is definitely a Nobel Prize. This is definitely a best book. And then when you look at it later, you realize this was not any of the above.
So it's true then to say that writing a novel is really an exercise in just revision and doing it over again and again until eventually it's the best thing it could be.
Absolutely. It went through many drafts. It went through numerous critiques. And of course, I gave readings out to a lot of people to be able to look at it and to give me advice. In the end, it falls down to the writer, and you've got to make the decisions. Several times I was told by really good writers that this doesn't work and that doesn't work. And to me, they worked, and I left them in, and I think it was good that I did. So you've got to be strong enough to also make your own decisions.
Let's get to the.
You can't be sensitive about it.
Yeah. Let's get into the meat of this book. You dedicate this book to those who treasure our Constitution and Bill of Rights and who are willing to fight to maintain it. In the last 6 years, I mean, there's plenty of moments you could point to where you could see our Constitution and our rights are maybe under attack. I was curious, though, if there was a particular event that you were thinking about when you wrote this dedication.
Well, probably January 6th was more in my mind than anything. Although I think that this year's off presidential election is probably as important as any election that we've ever had, because the crazies are coming out of the woodwork. And if we really treasure our democracy, and if we really believe in the Bill of Rights, we need people who are going to protect it.
You waste no time at all. I think it's, if I should look it again, but it's in the first few pages we get really into the action of our novel, of your novel. Right away, Supreme Court Justice J.J. Richter, he's involved in a high-profile ecological case and is kidnapped. Did you do any research on what would happen if a real-life incident like this would occur?
I did tons of research.
Oh,
I was doing research constantly. And that's one of the things that my law training was very helpful in, because you have to be accurate. And this was accurate. Streets are accurate. Places are accurate. actions are accurate, automobiles are accurate, whatever it was, I researched it, and I pride myself on the fact that we've had no criticism at all about the accuracy of anything.
I'm not criticizing the accuracy, but I do want to ask you about one of these pieces you do bring up in the book. You say that it's a tradition within the Supreme Court to decide all cases on the docket by the end of the term. And if a judge is missing in real life, they will not adjourn it. Is that really true? Do you think that would really happen?
Absolutely true. A judge to the Supreme Court has to be appointed by the president, approved by the Senate.
Right.
And if a judge is missing, and it's happened on several occasions, judges have been sick. I think it was Kennedy, fell off his bike and was out for a couple of weeks and missed the arguments. Those judges have to be approved. Therefore, it would be an 8-vote. And that was the whole focus of this book. Because if JJ is missing, they go ahead with 8 votes. And he was the swing vote. And that really became the focal point and made everything easier.
JJ Richter, you describe as a liberal curmudgeon. How much of Alan Miller is in JJ?
JJ is a man after my own heart.
I know that. I could tell that right away by reading it. You also mentioned there's a bit of you and Mort as well. I think when we talked briefly, how so?
Well, I went to undergraduate and law school at Syracuse, and I used that for the background of both Mort, who comes from Harrisburg. I once lived in Harrisburg. And Danny, who is a graduate of the law school. And all of that and Syracuse and the memories that were conjured up of it were very important to me. They still are. And I guess I will bleed orange for the rest of my life because Syracuse is the orange. Well, they used to be the orange men. Now they're just the orange.
I didn't realize your background, you went to Syracuse until I was reading the section where she's talking to J.J. Richter when she wants a clerk for him. And then I happened to come across your LinkedIn profile and I saw that and I'm like, I know where Danny comes from. Was there...
That's where Alan came from.
That's where Alan came from. I have a fun little question for you. So was there any reason you chose to have the assailants, the people at the very beginning, the kidnappers, to have an Obama mask and a Reagan mask? Was that a conscious decision? Because I thought it was funny as a reader to have two presidents from two very different eras with two very different political ideologies as the people that kidnapped Richter.
It was a conscious decision.
Really? Okay.
Because I didn't want to make it overly political one way or the other, because it wasn't. So they went into a store and they picked masks and they put those masks on. And that's how they hid themselves.
What kept my interest in reading your novel was trying to make sense of the motivation and even the identity of the kidnappers. Was it greed? Was it really about the Big Water Energy Supreme Court case? Was there a grudge involved against Richter in some past case? Was it an energy company that was working in the background? I'm wondering, you mentioned before how you kind of develop the form as you're moving into the novel, as you're writing it. And did you decide early on the details of the kidnapping, why they did what they did, or was this something you discovered as you were writing the novel?
Well, without giving the whole book away, the kidnappers are promised $10 million apiece if they can kidnap JJ and keep him safe for 2 weeks. It wasn't the intention to kill him. And if he had been killed, they would have blown their whole contract with the ultimate instigators of the kidnapping. So that, that was a very conscious decision.
You describe the President Chester as trending towards obesity and not very bright. He's also a war hero, was a farmer, and a darling of the emerging right-wing party. You could have done any easy caricature of someone on the right. Trump comes to mind, but instead you chose to make an original character, was wondering if you could talk about why.
And again, that was a conscious decision because I didn't want it to be just everybody picturing Donald Trump, for whom I have absolutely no regard. That's the political side of me. That's not the writer side of me. So I wanted it to be consistent with the story, a right winger, but not someone who was off the wall, a right winger who still knew how to do the right thing when it came to doing that.
Is this true, Alan?
We used to have some of those.
Yeah, we did. Because I actually found myself in moments admiring Chester and admiring the integrity he'd have in moments of making very difficult decisions. So you won me over with him.
Well, good. I would have voted for him against a lot of people, certainly against Trump.
And then, is this true, Alan? I think you mentioned in passing, you're in contact with someone in Hollywood right now about adapting this book into a film?
Well, we have somebody looking at it. And, you know, I was teaching screenwriting and involved with the screen long enough to know that having somebody looking at it and saying, yes, I'm going to put something together and having it actually come to fruition is generally whistling in the dark. But in this case, they found the money man who is willing to finance it. And whether we can get it beyond that, I don't know.
And my last question for you. You mentioned before you are working again on another novel. Is it going to be a follow-up to Holding Court? It's something else completely different. What is that like?
It's involving the same main characters with new adventures.
Very good. This has been my time talking with Alan Miller about his new novel, Holding Court. Alan, thanks so much for being on our show.
Josh, I thank you very much.
And now this. You're listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. I'd like to thank our special guests tonight, Michael Oren and Alan Miller, and all our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at KFAI.org/Right on Radio. You can listen to all of your favorite Right on Radio episodes on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and so on. Now please stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.